Accession number 27310, real one.
Sidney Garber, real one. Can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
I was born in London, Stratford, in 1922. October 1922.
And what did your father do for a living?
My father was in the gown manufacturing business. He came over to England in 1921 from Russia, as it was then. He came here, and he'd arranged him. He'd met my mother before, and they married then.
Do you have any brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have two brothers, both younger than I. 4 years difference between the 4 years and then 8 years. They're still with me. And between us, we've got many, many children and grandchildren.
What about your education? Where was that?
At age 11, I won a scholarship to go to Hackney Downs Secondary School, which was known as the former Grocers Company School. That was in Hackney. I left there in early 1939. Then I went to work in various companies. That was that.
What at school, was there anything that you particularly enjoyed, or did you have any sports that you
I did get my school colours for swimming and soccer, and if I had a better subject, it was mathematics and mechanics.
Did that come in useful in your later career?
No, not at all, not at all.
So when you left... You left school, you employed. What type of employment did you do?
I went into a company called, they made kitchen equipment, large-scale kitchen equipment. But when war broke out, that company collapsed, and I went to work in a garment factory.
Now, prior to the outbreak of war, had you any kind of inkling that war was coming?
Well, there was a scare in 38 when we thought we were going to be evacuated. I was still at school at that stage, so we had that particular worry. No, apart from that, other things were more important to us as 16-year-old people.
And what did you feel when war was declared? Did you think you would be involved?
I would have thought it was going to happen because the first conscripts, because we brought in conscription a few months earlier, and the first conscripts were going. A cousin of mine went on day 10 or something. So we knew it was serious, but apart from that, thoughts of what I was going to do and what I wasn't going to do, I don't know.
And were you in London during the Blitz?
I was in London during the Blitz, yes. They formed, before the Home Guard, there was a thing called the LDV, Local Defence Volunteers. And I joined that when it started and remained with them. And as such, we were there during the Blitz. And until I went into the services, I was in London during the Blitz, yes.
When you were a member of the LDV, where did you do your training?
Well, I was living in Hackney in East London, and our local drill hall was where we were trained. Occasionally we went out to rifle ranges. I never knew where they were. They took us by car or coach. There I was, I don't know how, why, where I was made a sergeant in the Home Guard. As a machine gun instructor, Lewis gun instructor. Why? God alone knows.
What equipment did you have? Because obviously, with the Home Guard and the LDV, they weren't as well equipped initially, were
no,
they?
No, we were equipped with with rifles, machine gun, and Lewis machine guns. The Lewis gun was a throwback to World War One, and the rifles were American, and they didn't have the same caliber bullets as the British standard Lee Enfield. We had .300, and the .303 was the British standard. But that was a home guard. How we would have fared, I don't know.
I was going to say, what type of people were in the Home Guard at that time?
It was composed, to a large extent, by World War One veterans. But there was also a measure of younger element in it. But the NCOs generally, I mean, I was unusual in that I was not a First World War veteran. But they were the most part, they were the ones who knew more about war.
And how many times would you attend the Home Guard training?
I think we had two nights a week. We did guard duty at various places. But I think it was mostly two nights a week. But then we were also used at odd times for standing guard on bond properties and various other things.
And you obviously mentioned the equipment that you had, but were you fully kitted out in a uniform?
We had a uniform of sorts, yes. We were issued with boots. We had denim clothing. We had a uniform.
Now obviously, you said you remember during the Blitz period. Yeah. Do you have any memories of the German Air Force attacks on East London?
Well, being in the Blitz, we were at home, we were straddled by bombs. I also was when I, the first day, first Saturday of the Blitz, I was in the other part of London, I dashed home. And we reported to the barracks, and they sent us off to stand guard outside bomb premises for whatever that was worth. But that was the involvement, yes.
And obviously, at home, did you have an air raid shelter, or did you use a community?
There was an air raid shelter close by. I very rarely used it. My parents were both alive at the time. And we all stayed at home, but when it got a bit more intense, we went across the road, or my mother and father went across the road. Father never went because he suffered from TB, and he wasn't in favour of these restricted places, so that was a difficulty.
But how intense was it during that period, the bombing? Would it be every night, or...?
Yes, it was. Bear in mind, I was as a youngster, and I normally just sort of don't get involved in worrying too much about it. For instance, if I had to go out on call out for patrol duty or guard duty, I'd walk through the streets, even though aircraft were overhead. Maybe it was the ignorance of youth, I don't know.
Was that similar with a lot of your fellows?
I can't say that I had a lot of similar thinking friends. For the most part, my friends were doing other things. None of my friends joined the Home Guard. Why on earth I joined, God alone knows. I would have said that I had this intense sense that something had to be done, but I can't say that my friends shared my view. They had other views.
Well, obviously, while you were there, you realised that at some stage you were going to be called up.
Yeah.
Did you want to have a choice in that matter of what you went
into? Well, that's exactly why I applied to join the Fleet Air Arm. It sounds crazy at the time, but my experience in the Home Guard and the roughness of living with the kind of army mentality told me that I didn't want to be in the army. So I decided to apply to join the Fleet Air Arm. And why did I select the Fleet Air Arm? Because somebody told me I couldn't get in.
Why did he tell you that?
Well, One doesn't know the being a Jew and the son of naturalized parents. There was a thought that you wouldn't be made a naval officer with that kind of background. As it was, it mattered very little. It didn't happen because I was selected, and that was that.
So there was a selection procedure, I take it, an interview that you had?
There was an interview. I first did an IQ test, which was a General Navy IQ test, and it must have been successful because I was asked then to go along to a Navy Fleet Arm Selection Board in Cockspur Street, and I was very proud of the fact there were 32 of us there that day, and of the 32, only 4 were selected for further training. This would have been in 1941, October 41. So they were being selective, and of that 4, only I was the only one that made pilot in the end. So I was very proud of that particular fact. And don't even ask me why they picked me out, because I haven't got a clue. I knew nothing about aircraft. I knew nothing about ships.
What type of things did they ask you? Can you remember?
Well, I was helped by the fact that I was a sergeant in the Home Guard. That may have taken. But they asked, first of all, they had various models on the table and asked me to identify them and why did I want to join the Fleet Air Arm. I answered them, and apparently I must have answered successfully. But it was an interview board of about 5 people, ranging from fairly thick brings around them into a younger officer. And they all asked relevant questions of history and what have you. Yeah, I think they were looking for character, I don't know.
Given the reason you wanted to volunteer for it in the first place, you said because you
somebody
wanted to let you, I take it you didn't say that at the selection board?
No, I told them lies.
So what happened next? Did you receive an acceptance that you...
Yes, I was told I was accepted and that I would be put on what is called the Y scheme. That was to show that I was in reserve. My service history tells me that I joined the Navy in November 41, which was the time of my examination. But I didn't actually apply down to what's it called, Portsmouth. Leon Solon till something like July 42. So in that intervening time I was in London, I was in the Home Guard, and I had this badge of the Y scheme on my shoulder, God alone knows what it meant, and that was that. And then they called me up and I went down to Leon Solon.
What happened when you arrived at Leon Solon?
Well, we all reported there, all our civilians reported there. We had a mixture of green people like myself who've just joined the service that particular time, but there was also quite a solid batch of New Zealanders who, when they did their army service in New Zealand, they were offered the option at the end of a certain period of training to either re-enlist in the Navy Fleet Air Arm or go on to the army. So we had quite a few New Zealanders there, and so they were old soldiers by that time because they travelled from New Zealand in a troop ship, and they'd learned all the wrangles. So they were the experienced people. We were all green, and at Leon Solon we did we got our uniforms and did a certain amount of training. We were only there for 2 weeks, I seem to remember.
What uniform did they issue with you?
Bell bottom trousers.
So it was a naval rig?
Naval rig, yeah. Yes, we were a naval rig, but we had a white cap band as a
trainee officer.
Did that mark you out in the barracks at all?
Well, no, not really, because it was, we were all the same. We were all the recruits were in Square Rig, and we were all as green as each other.
What about the accommodation? What kind of?
We're in huts, wooden huts, something like 20 to a hut, something like that. We went through the usual square bashing and marching and what have you there. But the real training came when we moved to St Vincent.
So you did, what was it, you said how long you were...
2 weeks, I think, to remember, Leon Solon.
And is that just really an introduction to the Navy?
Just an introduction to the Navy, yes. We were lectured on various things and, yeah, that was just an introduction to the Navy.
So you moved over to St Vincent.
Yeah.
Is that where Fleet Air Arm training started?
That's right. At that time, that's where we took on the first aspects of Fleet Air Arm. I remember we did at St Vincent, in addition to square bashing and PT and what have you, we had navigation, aircraft recognition, signalling, you know, Morse code and the various other things.
Did you do any flag work at all?
Flag work, what?
Semaphore,
yes, all part of the...
What kind of degree or level of training did you go to there? Because obviously with navigation, was it elementary navigation?
I think, what's it called? Triangle of Forces and various other ways, how to plot for drift and wind speeds and what have you.
Was there a failure rate on the course at that stage?
I don't think so. I don't seem to remember anybody getting busted, no. It was I forget how long it took, it could have been 8 weeks. And we all went on from there to three different elementary flying training schools.
So did you feel that course had given you kind of a very good basic
grounding? It gave us a grounding into the Navy. Yes, the other thing, we went onto water. We did boat pulling on water. That I seem to remember that was done at St Vincent. Yeah.
Did you do any other aspects of seamanship? I mean, I'm thinking knot tying or...
Yes, knots. Knots were part of the deal. We had a few old salts showing us how to do that, yeah.
So it sounds very much like almost a basic seamanship.
It was a basic Navy training for any recruit that went into the Navy, but with Fleet Air Arm inflections on it, yeah.
So where did you go to do your elementary flying?
I went up to Birmingham, Elmden, which is the Elmden, which was one of the things. Elmden, the other one was up at Sealand in Chester, and the other one was Pensacola.
And at Elmden, what did you start to do there?
With Elmden, we went into tiger moths.
Can you tell me about the tiger moth as an aircraft? What it looked like? How it behaved?
Well, it was fairly basic aircraft, a two-seater with the I can't remember now whether the instructor sat at the front or the back. It was a grass field, Elmden, at that time. We landed, took off on grass. Tiger moth was open cockpit. They took us into basic flying, where we did loops and rolls and landing and gliding and forced landings, yeah. Night flying, first introduction to night flying, which is fairly fearsome.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, you don't know. You get in the plane and you take off with an instructor. You can't see a damn thing. We had no lights. We only had the vaguest, the smallest lights on the aircraft. And we had to learn how to land on a flare path. When you first take off, you don't know your arm from your elbow. But you'll get familiar with it, and eventually it has no real fears.
How do you find the direction at night, where you want to go?
Well, you, if you were on instruments, you'd navigate by direction. But at Elmden, which was the we fly, how will we know? I can't remember now. We would do a circuit and come back into the landing path. But I can't remember. I can't remember whether we did cross countries from Elmden at night time. I don't think we did. No, it was merely to familiarise ourselves with flying a course at night, landing and taking off.
Who were your instructors?
Instructors were RAF pilots, RAF instructor pilots. All the instructors at Elmden were RAF. There were no Navy people. They were generally pilot officers or flying officers.
Did you have the same instructor, or would you rotate them?
Yeah, no. Each instructor had four pupils. And you would, with... You would remain with that organisation. In fact, my instructor at Elmden was a flying officer, Trout, who had a fantastic history of flying Tiger Moths. He had been one of the pilots before the war at an air display. Three Tiger Moths took off chained together. And they did their flying, and he was one of the pilots on this particular thing. He had a wealth of something like 8,000 hours of instruction flying, and he managed to kill himself on the last day of the course.
How did you see that? Oh, you were
no, I got this story that I was flying with him. We had to do 60 flying hours, and the last day of the course was Saturday, and. We were around the aerodrome and we saw the YMCA tea wagon down at dispersal. So he said, come on, we're going and land and get a cup of tea. So we got it landed, went over to the tea wagon, and while we were there, other pilots had landed, and one of the other guys on my course, one of the other guys who was his pupil, he said to him, flying officer Trout said to this chap, how many hours you got to do now to make the 60? And he said, I've got an hour and 20 minutes. And he said to me, how much are you going? I said, 25 minutes. He said, well, you find another instructor and I'll take Edelman up to do it. And they took off and both were killed. They hit another aircraft at a nearby aerodrome, and they were both killed. So that was the end of flying officer Trout, with a tremendous amount of experience.
Was there a danger of collision in the area that you were training in at all?
Well, when you're flying, there's always a danger. I didn't feel there was any particular danger. We landed and took off according to our instructions, our drill, our experience, and there were no other accidents that took place in the 8 weeks we were at Elmden.
How did you communicate with your instructor in the Tiger Moth?
With a voice tube. You each had earphones and voice tube, and he'd shout his instruction or whisper his instructions as it came along.
And obviously, you sound like you had a good relationship with your instructor. Was that always the case between
No, some of them were absolute disciplinarians and stood offish, and some were friendly. No, by and large, very civil, but between trainees and officers.
Would you have followed a sequence of instructions till you soloed? Would there have been?
Oh yes, you had to. You had to do various things. You went off and you did your instructional time, and eventually the instructor would say, well, now you go and do it yourself, get in and do it yourself. And that varied. Some of the finest of the pupils were able to fly solo after four and a half hours of instruction. I actually took, it was 7 minutes before I took off a solo. And it depends. It was interesting that the guy that was the quickest to get to fly solo in our organisation went on to be quite a good fighter pilot. I was probably of a much more medium standard, and I was a torpedo pilot, a trainer, torpedo bomber pilot.
But 7 hours sounds quite above average, no?
Well, I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know.
Did you enjoy flying at that?
I loved it. I adored it, every moment of it. Nothing was, you know, I was never happier than flying.
Had you ever flown prior to getting into that time?
Not at all. Not at all. I couldn't even drive a car. I couldn't, when I tell my grandson that I could learn to fly before I could drive a car, he couldn't believe me.
So the training went on. Did you, obviously once you'd soloed, there's a little bit more advanced training.
Once you'd soloed, you then developed from there. You developed various other techniques. You also went on cross-country navigation, and you would do, for instance, we had one exercise with low-level flying, cross-country, and then you did a low-level cross-country. It was all part of the... I don't think we did formation flying at EFTS. I don't think so. We did it at SFTS, but we didn't do it at EFTS.
What's low-level flying like in comparing with the training flying that you've done before?
Fascinating. I like that, and I even simulated... You could simulate low flying if you played around with clouds, because when you're flying, you don't get any impression of speed. But if you get yourself alongside a cloud, then the speed becomes apparent. So that's why I used to enjoy playing silly buggers, flying around clouds.
Are there any things to really try and avoid when you're low flying?
Going too low. And also telegraph wires. You have to be. And in those days, of course, barrage balloons were also... So you steered very clear of those. You knew exact. You should have known exactly where they were because they were plotted on the local maps. But nevertheless, you had to keep your eyes open.
One of the things that, for people who've never flown, seems terrifying is the process of learning how to get out of a spin.
Well, it used to be said that if anybody boasted of being a pilot and you wanted to test him, you asked him how to get out of spin, because there was a formula. Which was stick forward and opposite rudder. That's a formula that you should know.
Is that a natural action to do when you're in a spin, initially?
A natural action is... you were a part of the training is you put yourself into a spin, and that they attempted to teach you. No, if you... As with all things flying, when you're in trouble, you have to think very quickly.
So you ended your period
there
at Elms, and where did you go next?
I went to Canada, Kingston, Ontario.